Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bob Weeks, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Program Committee and your chair for tonight's program. I'm also a member of the House of Delegates of the American Bar Association, where I first met our speaker, Steve Zack. Tonight's program is a part of a series of programs underwritten by the Charles Geschke family, which examines the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century. This series examines the balance between safety, security, and public order on the one hand, and the protection of civil liberties and the integrity of the Constitution on the other. Tonight's program will focus on threats to our American justice system caused by underfunding and indecisiveness. Before introducing our speaker, I'd like to mention that tonight's question and answer portion of the program will be moderated by Professor Jeffrey Hazard, the Thomas E. Miller Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Hastings. Professor Hazard is a leading expert in the fields of civil procedure and legal ethics and is very good at asking questions. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Stephen Zack, President of the American Bar Association. With nearly 400,000 members, the ABA is the largest voluntary professional membership organization in the world. Mr. Zack is the first Hispanic American to serve as ABA president and is the second to be born abroad. He was only 14 when his family immigrated from Cuba under very harrowing circumstances, including last-minute detention by the secret police. But he made it here. And two lines from a patriotic song come to mind when I think of him. This is my country, land of my choice. This is my country, here I found voice. And what a voice it is. Mr. Zack earned his ABA and JD degrees at the University of Florida, and he's now in their Hall of Fame. He's a partner in the Miami office of the national law firm of Boies, Schiller & Flexner, LLP, specializing in commercial litigation. His clients range from former Vice President Al Gore, in the Bush versus Gore case, to Philip Morris, to the National Geographic Society. And he's listed in the 2011 edition of the Best Lawyers in America. His cross-examination of an expert witness in Bush versus Gore made the front page of the New York Times, and he's got it framed in his office. Mr. Zack was the youngest attorney and first Hispanic to serve as president of the Florida Bar. He was chair of the Florida Ethics Commission and served on the Orange Bowl Committee and the Florida Constitution Revision Commission. In the ABA, Mr. Zack has been Florida State Delegate, chair of the House of Delegates, which is our policymaking body, served on the Board of Governors, and is a life fellow of the American Bar Foundation. As ABA president, he has led national efforts to protect state courts, improve civics education, and fight cuts to legal aid funding. It is his mission to make equal justice under law a vibrant living reality for everyone, and not just four words carved on the facade of the Supreme Court building in Washington. Mr. Zack is a passionate, eloquent, and tireless advocate for liberty and justice for all. As he wrote in a letter in today's Daily Journal, our local legal newspaper, quote, "That's what our profession does. We get in the way of wrong. We get in the way of attempts to separate and divide our society. We get in the way of those who would let our constitutional democracy wither away from neglect and ignorance. We get in the way of those who would further widen the justice gap in our country." Please welcome a great lawyer, my friend and our speaker, Steve Zack, President of the American Bar Association.
That was a wonderful introduction, Bob, and thank you for those kind words and for all the good work you do at the ABA and have done for many, many years. And thank you for this invitation to what is the world's largest public affairs forum. And I love your motto, find truth and set it free. What could be better than that? I've heard many mottos over the years, but I truly think that in many ways it's what we are all about here today and finding some truth and hopefully setting it free. Because we need to explain why the preservation of the justice system is so important. It should be obvious, right? It should be a very simple discussion. Unfortunately, it's not. In my lifetime, the loss of liberty is not a theoretical exercise. I actually experienced that in Cuba. And part of the passion that I feel about this issue comes from the fact that in 1961, the Cuban Constitution was identical to that of the United States. And those words in that Constitution did not protect us. Words do not protect you. Understanding and believing in the words do. And we today have a serious problem in that regard. The New York Times 3 weeks ago, excuse me, the Time magazine 3 weeks ago reported as a cover story how the Constitution is under siege. And Newsweek about 2 months ago had a cover story about the failure of Americans to understand our government. Some very scary statistics. Two out of every three graduating high school students today believe that the three branches of government are Republican, Democrat, and Independent. That is an actual poll. 75% of all Americans don't know that religious freedom is protected by the First Amendment. 75%. More Americans can name the judges on American Idol than on the Supreme Court of the United States. What does this mean to us, and how did we get here? Well, first of all, unless the next generation understands the obligations imposed by the Constitution, we're going to have a serious, serious problem. My children, if they're like your children, can always tell me about their rights, but very, very rarely tell me about their responsibilities. And those responsibilities are critical to our future as a country. Now, the fact of the matter is that if we do not understand the Constitution, if our children do not understand the Constitution, and appreciate the separation of powers, and appreciate the different roles that our branches of government are meant to play, how are our elected officials supposed to understand it? What has happened today in Washington? What is happening to our country? What is happening to a saying that we all have heard? And I'm going to ask people to raise their hands for a second. Do you remember going to school when we all heard the statement, "I don't agree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it"? Do you remember that? How many of you recall saying that? Every single person in this room raised their hand. Today, the statement is, "I don't agree with what you say, and if you say it, you're a bum, and you shouldn't say it, and I don't like you." Where did we lose our way? What happened to us as a country where we cannot have a civil discord and discussion amongst ourselves and still respect the other point of view? Is it 24-hour-a-day cable? Is it a society that says, "I won't listen to Fox," or "I will listen to Fox and only Fox," or "I listen to MSNBC"? Why can't we listen to the marketplace of ideas and understand that people have a right under our Constitution to have different points of view? That's why you're here today, to listen to different points of view. You know, the fact of the matter is that today we are in a society that does not even respect the concept of having a right to a lawyer. As president of the American Bar Association, I had an opportunity to choose the theme for our law day, our National Law Day. And I chose the legacy of John Adams from Concord to Guantanamo. Because every high school student had to think about why it is our obligation to defend those who have ideas different than our own. Why we live in a constitutional democracy. A constitutional democracy is the difference of two words, each of which are two letters. And that is the rule of law and the rule by law. The rule by law is when a majority gets together and decides what rights, if any, the minority has. Nazi Germany was one of the most lawful and unjust societies in the history of the world. The Nuremberg Laws were rules by law. What exists around most of the world and in Cuba today, in my own experience, is that the most powerful, the most privileged, get together and decide what rights, if any, the minority has. The United States Constitution is the rule by law. And the rule by law is to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority, which is the classic definition of law. Now, the rule of law is what Justice Kennedy and Justice Roberts recently spoke about. In their opinions, one was involving the flag burning case, Texas versus Johnson. The other one, that was by Justice Kennedy. And the other one was by Justice Roberts very recently in the demonstrations at military funerals. And they both said the same thing, in effect. They said, we don't like what these people did. A matter of fact, what they did and their beliefs are abhorrent to most Americans and to us personally. But unless we protect their rights, all our rights are in jeopardy. And that is why the concept of a constitutional democracy is so important and must be preserved, but is not understood today. It's not understood by many Americans. And why? It's not that hard to understand. We live in a democracy. A democracy is supposed to be governed by majority opinion. So why isn't the court just governed by whatever a majority of people think? Well, the answer is that that's what's also called mob rule. A constitutional democracy is one that protects everyone's rights, even those who are in the minority. And that is a concept that was discussed in the Federalist Papers, which I know we all read when we have trouble going to sleep, and is the basis for our government. But what will happen? What will happen if there are no courts to protect the rule of law? Because that is really the fundamental message that I wish to talk to you about here today. We have a court system under attack. 11 states provide less than 1% of their entire state budget to funding the judicial system. California and Florida always tend to lead the pack. In this case, unfortunately. Florida, 0.7% of the entire budget goes to funding the judiciary. The Superior Court in San Francisco recently said that it will have to reduce its staff by 42% compared to where it was 2 years ago, and that it will have to close 25 courtrooms. We have established a commission for the preservation of the justice system that is chaired by Ted Olson and David Boies, speakers at this great forum in the past, and 24 of the most prominent lawyers in this country, both women and men, all ethnicities, both sides of the aisle, to look at this issue. Let me tell you what we found. In hearings around the country, we found this Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Georgia telling us that their court is so underfunded that she has to ask NexusLexis for pencils for her law clerks. In Ohio, you can't file a pleading unless you bring your own paper. In New Hampshire, the court closed the courts to all civil jury trials for a year. A year. Alabama Supreme Court Justice said she's going to have to reduce civil trials by 50% and criminal cases by a third. Well, we have just spent $1.3 trillion in bringing the rule of law to parts of the rest of the world. The rule of law begins with one word, access. Access. And if there's no access, there is no rule of law. And today we have a justice gap in this country where 80% of poor people do not have access to the court. 80%, mostly minorities and women. We have a legal services corporation that is so underfunded that one out of every two phone calls goes unanswered. And we have not only the traditional minorities and poor, we have the newly poor. The foreclosure crisis has caused a whole vast new number of people that cannot afford to go into court. But even if they could afford it, if the courts are closed, there's no access. There is no access. And around the country, the courts are closing down. The head of the civil division in Los Angeles, Lee Edmond, told me that had the original budget gone through, they would have had to close 150 courtrooms. Close them. Now, who cares? Is this really important? Aren't these just a bunch of troublemakers going to court, clogging up the court system? Does it make any difference to, you know, the business community or to average Americans who don't need the court system? Well, we're all going to be a minority someday in some way, and we're all going to need the court system. And the fact is that this is as important to the business community as any other community, and that's something that, frankly, has not been written about and that we learned during the course of these commission hearings, that we had CEOs of Fortune 50 companies and general counsel and economists tell us that there are hundreds of millions, in fact, billions of dollars tied up in the court system between powerful corporations that cannot get their day in court, because the courts aren't there. They're closed down. And they can't put it on their balance sheet. If they could put it on their balance sheet, they could have new jobs. They create new technologies. But they don't know whose money it is. In Los Angeles, they said, the most recent report says, they have lost $16 billion in economic value because the courts have been closed, $1.6 billion in taxes. We have been the envy of the world as to our justice system. And as the world becomes smaller, and as multinational corporations decide where they will invest their money, they have historically invested it in the United States because we have had a court system that has been the envy of the world. But they won't continue to do that if they can't get justice in America. So there's an economic reason as well as a moral reason to make sure that our courts are open. And we have a crisis in our federal system. 92 vacancies exist today in the federal court system. 15% of our federal court is vacant. We have 26 districts under federal emergencies, judicial emergencies. And last session, for example, we had 18 judges come out with no opposition on either side. And it wasn't a political issue. Couldn't get one of them through Congress. You know, when I talk to these graduating students, I just went through that season and had a chance to talk to many, many graduating law students. And I talked about those four words. And I said, you know, you've read millions and millions of words to get to today, but you only have to think about four words. And they are inscribed over the Supreme Court of the United States, and that's equal justice under law. And it doesn't say equal justice for the rich and the powerful and the privileged. It says equal justice. And under law means the rule of law and the rule of the Constitution. When I left Cuba that night, and we were taken off a plane by G2, which is their KGB equivalent, my family, and held incommunicado in a private rooms. They weren't cells, actually. They were just locked rooms. Didn't know whether you were ever going to see your family again. It only takes one night of that to change your life forever. And in many ways, I truly believe that was the moment I decided to be a lawyer, because I never wanted to feel so helpless again in my life. And I also knew that what was happening there was wrong and that somebody should care about it. If I ever had an opportunity to make a difference and to care, that I would do that. I believe that that moment is one that emphasized to me the importance of the rule of law and why we have to preserve our system of justice. Most importantly, I remember that night because of a conversation I had with my grandfather. And we had learned that the business he had worked his whole life for to establish was being taken over. And what happens is they come to your house, they arrest you because you're an enemy of the state when they take over your business. And so we left immediately with the clothes, you know, on our back. And I said to my grandfather, I said, you know, how do you feel? And he said, you know, I obviously feel terrible. But I feel good about one thing. I said, how could you feel good about anything on a night like tonight? And he said, I feel good that I'm going to the United States. And I know that I'll never be a refugee again, because if the United States falls, there'll be no place to go. So when I think of your words, that I have found my voice and my place, to me, this is a promise made many years ago to my grandfather that he had nothing to worry about. And that is why this is a message that we must continue to talk about, and we must engage the American people to make sure that they want us as a profession and as a society to get in the way of people who do not want to respect the rights of others. Thank you very much.
Steve wants to stand up there, if I understand it. Yep. And my job is to read a selection, which I've made, of questions, which were very good and covered a wide range. And those of you who may not hear your question as one that I've selected, just have in mind that we had very good questions, just too many. Now, should I make this announcement about the Commonwealth Club?
Sure.
This is for the radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Stephen Zak, president of the American Bar Association, who is talking about threats to the American justice system caused by underfunding of our courts, and I might say as well, under appreciation of our courts. So with that in mind, I've made a selection of the questions. And let me start with this, if I may, Steve. What can regular citizens, ordinary citizens, do to strengthen and uphold the U.S. justice system?
Well, I think maybe that's the seminal question as to why we're gathered here today and why we're talking about this issue, because lawyers alone will never accomplish that. And judges are the worst, because they're not supposed to be out there asking for money for their court system. And lawyers are viewed as self-interested individuals in the court system. It's actually the average citizen that has to demand the protection of the courts. Sandra Day O'Connor has one of the best statements. She says, in every society, there has to be a safe place. And in a democracy, that safe place is the courts. Well, we have to have the average citizen talking about that they want to preserve that safe place in our society and talk to their legislators, because there is a view among legislators, not all of them, but many, that the courts, and I've heard this actually used as a statement, is another agency. It is not another agency. It is a co-equal branch of government that is necessary to protect our fundamental liberty. And that to be a co-equal branch, it needs adequate funding. So when they say we have an economic crisis, we do have an economic crisis. There's no question about that. But don't put the courts as another library or another road. It is not. It is the basis why we today enjoy our freedom. And we've got to make that clearly understood. And every time you talk to a legislator, every time you have an opportunity to talk to a civic group, you need to make that distinction.
Thank you, Steve. The next question from our audience. If you could choose only one reform of the American justice system, what would it be and why?
It would be to depoliticize the funding of the justice system. What you have is the fact that the courts get in the way also. The courts often get in the way of the legislature or the executive branch doing what it wants to do. And it becomes very much a political issue as to the adequate funding of the courts. There should not be that tension that exists for the courts doing the right thing. There should be an opportunity in some states, and we're going to look at this next year in our commission resolutions. One state, for example, has a citizens committee that looks at the necessary funding for the state judiciary. And they determine a number based on empirical evidence. Then, unless the governor and the legislature affirmatively veto that number, that becomes the number for the justice system in the state. So I would like to see a way of disconnecting the two so that the justice system is adequately funded and we again provide access for our citizens.
The next question is rather different. How has the war on terror affected the American justice system in the past or up to now? And what do you foresee in the future?
Well, the ABA has spoken out about that issue on a number of occasions and the importance of preserving the Bill of Rights. You know, I think that Benjamin Franklin, we can't improve on what many of the things that Benjamin Franklin said hundreds of years ago. And he said that those who will sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. And the fact is that this is a real problem. I see it as being possibly a much greater problem. The think tanks that have looked at the issue, unfortunately, have said that in the next 10 years, there will be not one but two dirty nuclear bombs exploded in the United States. I hope they're wrong. But that is what the statistics show. And if, God forbid, that does happen, I believe that our fundamental democracy will be under the greatest attack it has ever experienced. And a matter of fact, one of the issues that we are looking at in the ABA is what would be the ABA's response in the event that there was a dirty nuclear bomb and habeas corpus was suspended in the United States, as it was by Lincoln and by Roosevelt. A lot of people don't remember that and don't know it. And England, I was just in England talking to their lawyers and to their security people there as to they have a much, you know, they don't have a constitution, and they have much different abilities to hold people for much longer periods of time and what they would do under similar circumstances. So it's an issue we're thinking about and an issue that the American Bar Association will have to respond to.
In a very different sector of the set of problems that you've been wrestling with, are the problems faced by our justice system rooted in deep problems in legal education, especially spiraling student debt, forcing lawyers away from public interest and justice for the poor?
I think that's a very important question, one that I have been quite concerned about just having a son who graduated from a university that you used to teach at, Professor, and having a niece who graduated last year and another niece who's considering going to law school. So I've been looking at the economics of going to law school, and they're out of kilter. The profession is not to be a profession just for the rich. We must have a profession that looks like our society in every respect. And there are a number of things the ABA is doing in that regard. We have a resolution that's coming up in 3 weeks in Toronto at our annual meeting, which I call Truth in Legal Education, that tells people going to law school exactly what they're in for. And you need to understand that the accreditation part of the American Bar Association is under a completely separate organization as a result of a agreement we have with the Department of Justice and Department of Education so that we don't have any antitrust issues. So that is an independent group. But we as the American Bar Association are asking law schools to prepare, for example, just 10 simple questions about what it costs to go to law school, how many of their students are employed upon graduation in real jobs, not artificial jobs. And we think this is going to be very helpful. We also have a website that it has a lot of information for anybody considering to go to law school. But probably the most important statistic that these potential students don't know is that the median income of lawyers in the United States is $62,000. They need to understand that before they incur $100,000 in debt. Now, is there always room for another good lawyer? We absolutely need good lawyers. There always is. But you have to ask yourself, you know, how much debt you can afford. They've been watching too much Boston Legal. You see $180,000 starting salaries. Well, that may be for the top 10 law students and the top 10 law schools, but there were 40,000 graduates this year. So what are the other 39,000 going to do? There are jobs available and good jobs available, but we have to first, let them know what to expect upon graduation. Second thing we have to do is make sure we continue to have the profession look like our society. And two specific examples. Hispanics, lawyers, less than 4%, even though 16% of our society. African Americans, 8%, just way underrepresented. And what we're doing, the ABA is doing in that regard, is we have minority scholarships. We also have a clerkship program where we put minority students with federal judges and state judges. And we have a diversity center, which is there's only four missions of the ABA. One of them is to promote diversity within and without the profession. So, you know, and I saw recently a good trend that among the Ivy schools and other schools that they're actually giving free admission, no longer loan that they're loaning, but they're actually giving free admission to minority students to help provide more access for minorities. But we've got a long way to go to make sure that we can provide affordable law student education. One thing that I did just recently with one of my nieces is I said, why do you want to go to X school, which was not in her hometown, where she could live at home and go to the school and not have to incur all those expenses? You know, you're going to get as good an education there. So you need to make different decisions, and we got to give them a transparent environment to make those decisions in.
And still another quarter, which indicates the enormous range of the subject matter, arbitration. Is it a legitimate part of the legal system, or is it just a private system of justice?
Both. It's both. It is a private system of justice, and unfortunately it is only available to very often to people who have money. Again, what we call the rent-a-judge system that exists today, where you have retired judges who you can hire for somewhere between $500 and $1,000 an hour, to adjudicate your case is growing by leaps and bounds because they have no access to the court system that we just talked about. That doesn't make sense. Now, arbitration, mediation makes a lot of sense in some areas where we, for example, I'll give you a perfect example in Florida in foreclosure. The Supreme Court just said we need mandatory mediation before trial to try and do away with the logjam we have. Mediation is a very useful and efficient way of handling some cases, many cases, and it's part of the future of the practice of law, but it can't be the only part of the practice of law that we use to resolve disputes.
Okay. All right. We're in good shape. I've not been aware of how the time works here, but I'm learning quickly, I think. In a way, the arbitration system exists in opposition to another fundamental element of our legal system, which is the jury system. And we're very interested in your views about the role of the jury system, both in civil and in criminal cases.
Well, I strongly believe in the jury system, and I'm a trial lawyer. I'm a jury trial lawyer. That's what all I've done for 45 years. And my personal experience is that I have seen the collective wisdom of a jury actually be one of the most beautiful things you can witness in achieving justice. Sometimes the jury, still following the law, can see through a lot of legal arguments and do what's right, legally right. And that's a beautiful part of the jury system. I've been involved with the Magna Carta celebration, which is going to go into we're going to have an 800-year anniversary of the Magna Carta in 2015. And that is the genesis of the jury system. Surprisingly, England has virtually no jury system left as part of its justice system. We are the last bastion of the jury system. However, Japan just recently decided to inaugurate, because they never had it before, the jury system. And we are working with the Japanese who culturally, historically, are not comfortable with the jury system because they don't usually have discussions about differences, points of view. We actually show them the movie 12 Angry Men to demonstrate how one person can make a huge difference. We show them To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, there are lots of things that we do that we try to get them interested in the jury system, and it's growing, that interest. I'm worried about the jury system after some of these recent cases, and without opining on those cases, because to tell you the truth, I don't watch those cases because they frustrate me. I see things happen there that just shouldn't happen, either lawyers acting certain ways or judges acting certain ways, so I really don't follow it. Plus, I don't know what's being kept out from the jury, withheld by the judges and so forth. But what I do see is jurors being virtually attacked. You see what recently have happened to some of the jurors in recent cases. And we can't have that occur, because what will happen when you go to court and you need a jury trial and you need jurors? How many people are going to be jurors or wish to be jurors when they think that they're going to be followed around by press or people trying to get their phone number and harass them? We have to protect jurors. And I've tried a number of cases that have been very high publicity cases. And they've still been televised, but you haven't seen the jury's face. There's been a pool. I do believe in the public telecasting. I think it's very good to demystify the law as many ways as possible. It's not some fraternity that operates independently. And in Florida, the Supreme Court arguments, for example, are televised, all of them. I wish the United States Supreme Court would televise its proceedings. I think it would be very helpful to Americans understanding the justice system. So I'm in favor of the public seeing what goes on in courtrooms. I think we need to do more to protect jurors so that they can do their job and not worry about what happens after the trial.
If there were some other country that we were advising about their justice system, what would you recommend that they adopt from ours that they don't have? One might be the jury system. And what would you say to them about aspects of our system that they ought to be very skeptical about?
Well, I actually have had those conversations. During this year, I spend most of my time in the United States. I have visited 20 different countries, 30 cities in those countries, and spoken with the Chief Justice of virtually each of the countries that I have visited, including not very long ago, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Russia, where we had a long, almost two-hour conversation, one-on-one, talking about issues like this. And I'll tell you what happens in other countries and what they're doing. In Russia, for example, you have 200,000 jurists, that's the word they use. You don't even have to go to high school to be a jurist. You have no attorney-client privilege, and you go to court. They only have 35,000 avocats. An avocat is similar to an American lawyer because you have peer review, you have attorney-client privilege, you have requirement for a specific amount of legal education and so forth. And they handle the most difficult cases. And when I was talking to the chief, we were talking about how to professionalize, if you will, the legal profession. And the ABA was formed 133 years ago only for two purposes. One, to create a code of ethics for all lawyers. And the second one is to increase the quality of legal education. And that's still our fundamental mission. So one suggestion I made at that time to the Chief Justice is you've actually got to give lawyers a monopoly. The only way, this sounds self-serving and it's not in any way, the only way to professionalize it is to have a group of people that have a monopoly so that you can control that group of people, so that they are subject to an ethical code, and so that you can control their licenses and removal of their licenses if they act unprofessionally. And of course, you know, monopolies are not something that historically Russia would consider to be an option. So, you know, they have issues that they're considering over there. China, which I just returned from, they have just announced that they have 200,000 lawyers in China today. The Chinese government just announced that they are going to have 1 million lawyers in the next 10 years. And you might ask yourself, what country wants more lawyers? And let me tell you one thing about the Chinese. They're very, very smart. And an example of how the world has changed is more IPOs were done in Shanghai last year than in London and New York combined. All right, so it tells you where the world is shifting. So why do they need more lawyers? Well, they understand that they want to be the dominant economic and business powerhouse in the world, and they look at the American model. They need lawyers to ink those deals. So I would advise them to have a quality legal education as opposed to Brazil, where you have 1,000 law schools. You can open a law school for a couple hundred bucks, and you have a huge failure rate. You need, and we're working with the Brazilian colleges, law schools. I spoke down there to their PUC, which is their major university, about these issues, and they're doing what they can to increase. But I would tell them to make sure that the legal education is a quality legal education is the first step, to have a monopoly so that you can control the lawyers and make sure that they're acting in an ethical way. What would I think there was a third part of the question, which was, what would I tell them not to do? Yes. Oh, by the way, before I get to that, in Vietnam, I recently met with the president of their bar association that's similar to the American bar. They have, in most countries, they have a government bar association that's part of the government in effect. And then they just have a new bar association in Vietnam called the Federated Bar. And it was interesting because the person was 70-year-old Viet Cong, who was the chair. And truly one of the most interesting conversations I ever had, a person who didn't seem to hold any anger but wanted the help of America and said to me, would you send us your human rights information from the American Bar Association? The American Bar Association has one of the best legal libraries in the world. And Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh has just built a fabulous law school. They have no books. And we're trying to work with those foreign countries to provide them with legal materials because they've asked for it. They've also asked for lawyers to come over there and help them with their law students and their moot court competition and things like that. And we've reached out to the American Chamber to see if we could do some kind of exchange program using the assistance of the American Chamber. What I tell them not to do, I think that they ought to not, the same thing I said earlier, that they ought to try to find a separation of funding issues, that the government needs to make it not a political system. They need to look at what's adequate. And each of these countries, access seems to be the biggest issue. They always ask me about access. It's ironic that we have our own access issues, which we talked about earlier, but they are very, very concerned about not having sufficient access to the legal system for their citizens.
The problem of undernourishment, so to speak, of the justice system is one aspect of that, as you've talked about, is that at the trial level, the original access to justice. Someone here has written, are there similar problems in the slowing of the function of the appellate courts in resolving evolving legal issues? They mentioned particularly environmental law, but you could say the same would be true of many other branches of law, where the appellate system has become so sluggish, so slow, that often by the time a question finally gets resolved in an appellate court, particularly the Supreme Court, the practical utility of the resolution is obsolete because life has been moving along much faster underneath. Is that another dimension of this problem?
Well, it's certainly a problem. And again, to quote Winston Churchill, it's a terrible system. It's just better than any other one. I'll take Brazil for an example. Just met with the the Brazilian Supreme Court. And how would you like? And they have just met with the United States Supreme Court less than a month ago to deal with their issues. In Brazil, every matter that comes before the Supreme Court of Brazil is de novo review, meaning they had 80,000 cases last year. 80,000. Obviously, no justice there. You can't have a just system that wants to review 80,000 cases. So I do think our appellate system could use some tweaking. But by and large, the Florida, I'm not sure I agree with it, but to a degree, I most certainly respect it. And the Florida Supreme Court's motto is, you'll appreciate this, I'm not going to give you the Latin version because I can't remember it, but the translation is, soon enough, if correct. And that is the actual motto. Sometimes soon enough isn't soon enough. But you are correct with the, as you know, Professor, the Supreme Court of the United States takes so few cases that usually the intermediate appellate court's decision is the final one. And we have to fill the bench. It's gonna be worse every day if we have an empty federal bench that can't function. I know in the 11th Circuit today, circuit that Florida's in, we have two vacancies.
another dimension, it's been called to mind in this question that Justice Sotomayor was cross-examined in a rather aggressive way concerning her statement that a woman, I think she went on to say an Hispanic woman.
Wise Latina.
You're running way ahead of me here. could understand a lot of things much better than people, certainly such as I, and perhaps even you. So we're talking both about, so to speak, ethnic and cultural background and gender as affecting the way people understand what justice is.
Well, she, I thought she answered the question pretty well, and must have because she got confirmed. But the fact is that at the same time, Justice Alito, Italian-American, and he understands some of those cultural issues. It's interesting, the Supreme Court of the United States today has no Protestants on the Supreme Court. Isn't that interesting? I mean, we basically have Catholics and Jews, Jewish justices.
Well, I've been very worried about that, I'll tell you.
I mentioned this because I thought that was keeping you up at night.
Yes.
But the fact is that I have no doubt that they each will do what they said in their nomination, which is they were going to apply the law. And what Justice Roberts said is really probably the seminal statement on the issue, and that, you know, judges are supposed to call balls and strikes. That doesn't mean that they don't understand. And a matter of fact, the more why do you have a diverse jury? I mean, an appellate court is just another type of jury, right? In the final analysis. And the Supreme Court is a very different kind of jury. Because the Supreme Court, having had only one case before them, I learned very quickly that, precedent isn't as important as the position of the justices who are going to really in many ways decide what the law is. And they will change what the law is if they get a majority of their sisters and brothers to go along with them. So I think that to have a jury that is made up of diverse cultural views and understanding only makes us a stronger society. So I personally think it's a good thing. I don't think that you ever separate your life from what you do. Your personal experiences, some of the personal experiences I talked to you about tonight, shaped my life, and I think that they're important parts of the decision-making process I make, but they don't overwhelm the legal obligations I might have in a case.
So I'm going to ask a different kind of question, which is, do you see a difference between the idea of a constitutional democracy, which is a term you've used, and a constitutional republic?
I really don't. I mean, I use them interchangeably. I go back to, again, one of my favorites was Ben Franklin. When he left the Constitutional Convention, one of the people on the street asked him, what kind of government have you given us, Mr. Franklin? And he said, a republic if you can keep it. He could have easily said a democracy if you could keep it. I think that in many ways they're one and the same. And frankly, there may be some differences that people at some level view it, but I view it as almost interchangeable words.
Speaking of which, the ABA has recently given attention to the problem of lobbying. And in particular, the concern that, speaking of republics, that people who have access to money, businesses, but others as well, can hire voices whispering in the ear of congressmen, or maybe even more important, in the ear of staff of congressmen. What do you think? How do you think that's a serious problem? And what the ABA, what could the ABA be doing about it?
If you look at Caperton and how the Supreme Court looks at even funding of judicial elections, which are meant to be different than legislative elections. Remember that we have two branches of government that the framers decided would be controlled by a majority vote. That is the executive and the legislative. And they do a pretty good job of keeping their finger in the air, right? And I think that that people have a right to lobby. I think poor people don't have the same access as rich people. I think poor people have a lot of things that they can't do because of the resources they have available. But I think lobbying in general, as long as it is not anything that is secretive, and that's one of the big problems in lobbying is the secretive aspects of it. But as long as they don't violate the law, there's going to be lobbying. I think a bigger problem, and one that I'm glad I have a couple minutes to talk about, is the political action committees coming into states, the anonymous political action committees coming into states and targeting judges. That's a huge problem. Look at what happened in Iowa. You had a Supreme, you know about the two judges that got removed. We don't know about that. Okay, let me talk about that for a second. Two Supreme Court justices were removed in a by the voters because they voted in a unanimous opinion based on the Iowa Constitution and the United States Constitution on an issue involving gay rights. And an anonymous political action committee comes in and takes one sentence out of an opinion of these judges who have been on the bench for years and years and years and defeats them, removes them at the polls, and actually suggests that this is, and this is what the words of the organizers, this is a wake-up call to the judiciary. Actually, it should be a wake-up call to all Americans that we have a serious problem because we should not allow anonymous PACs to come into states and put millions of dollars to defeat judges based on one sentence and opinion. If they're going to have a PAC, let them register it and let them decide, let the people decide whether or not those judges acted in a way that was consistent with the Constitution. As a result of that, one of the things that I've asked, and this is going to be one of the most interesting debates in the next 3 weeks in Toronto, is the judicial recusal resolution coming before the House of Delegates. And I believe since Republican Party versus White, which is the case that said that judges have First Amendment rights, historically the judicial code said judges are not supposed to comment about how they would rule in a certain case, and they have a very strict code of conduct. Well, Republican Party versus White, decided by the United States Supreme Court, said that judges have First Amendment rights, so they can say anything they want. Well, the point is that if a judge says, I'm going to rule either for or against an abortion issue, without hearing the evidence during the course of a campaign, shouldn't that judge be disqualified by virtue of those statements? And also, if a judge is to be recused, that's the most difficult thing that a trial lawyer ever has to do. I will tell you that as a practicing trial lawyer, you will stay up nights and nights and nights before you will ever seek to recuse a judge.
Maybe
very serious.
A few people in the audience might be helped if you would define recusal.
Okay. Recusal is when you say to a court, you can't be fair. This is the person who's going to judge your case and your client's case. And you then write a motion that explains why you think this judge can't be fair. If you don't think that that is a tough decision, it's a tough decision on a lot of bases. One, for your client, his affidavits have to be filed. You should never file something like that. It's a very serious document. Even all documents may be serious, but there's nothing as or more serious than saying to a judge you can't be fair. So one of the things we're suggesting, for example, and historically, who do you think rules on that? the judge who you're saying can't be fair. Okay? Now, this is common sense. Something sometimes that's lost in the law, as Dickens pointed out many years ago. But we're suggesting that somebody other than that judge, another judge, look at that and determine whether it's facially sufficient, because that's the standard, is whether it's facially sufficient. So, and we're looking at issues like in Florida, if you give $500 to a judge, that's okay, but if you give more than that, that judge cannot hear your case. And if you are, let's say, the campaign manager for a judge, because we have elections, if anybody's interested, let me just finish that. If you're a campaign manager, you can't appear in front of that judge. The ABA spent 2 years on a report called Justice in Jeopardy, which is online, and talks about how judges are elected in every single state. By the way, one other document you might be interested in, because I understand you've had speakers talk about this recently, is immigration. And the ABA just issued, several months ago, the most comprehensive immigration reform report in the last two decades. It contained 10,000 pro bono lawyer hours of some of the best law firms in America. And part of the frustration that exists regarding immigration, and I was just at a two-day White House meeting Monday and Tuesday this week on this issue, it relates to the anger that people have saying, well, it's broken and we can't fix it, there's nothing we can do. Well, that's wrong. We have an ability to fix this problem. We should fix the problem, and the ABA has rendered a report and will continue to act as a resource in fixing the problem. So, again, these are things that the ABA has online. If you're interested, and most certainly you can visit our website. Or, by the way, if one of these questions, we don't get to your question, I'll see you out back. Pick up the phone, call me. Happy to talk to you about anything you want to talk about.
We should all remember that most of us are at least descendants of immigrants. One thing about justice in a different sense, I have a question here that says that some constitutions, and they mention the Cuban one, include health and literacy as basic rights. Should we think of those as basic rights? You'll certainly realize that, at least as to health, that's one of the key problems going on in the present debt ceiling controversy in Washington.
Well, my favorite book just recently, and I tell you it's $9.95 on Amazon, is President Kennedy's book called A Nation of Immigrants. It was written in the early 1960s. It'll take you a couple hours to read it again. It's a fabulous book, and it makes you realize that nothing's changed in the last 50 years. And he talks about why we're a nation of immigrants and why that has been the strength of America. So, yes, we all are a nation of immigrants. We should remember that in these debates. When I was asked to, Florida has an interesting process called the Constitutional Revision Commission, something that all states should adopt. But every 20 years, a group of 30 citizens are appointed by the governor, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, and the Supreme Court to rewrite Florida's Constitution, every single line of it. And it doesn't go to the legislature. So all those pesky lobbyists out there don't get a chance to lobby one way or another. It goes right to the citizens of the state. And it took us 2 years to do that. We looked at these issues. And in Florida's Constitution, a quality education is now in the Florida Constitution. And I do believe that in America particularly, everyone is entitled to a quality education. And most certainly, in this country, people should not go to bed hungry. That is just unacceptable. And the way that the misery index in this country is one that is way out of line because of the recent economic situation. And I don't think that we as a country even understand how this, how the unemployment has affected so many families. And we have a whole new strata called the newly poor, people who were driving Porsches yesterday and in breadlines today. But there is a tremendous sense of pain and suffering that goes along with the economic crisis that we have. And we need to make sure that Americans have the opportunity to have reasonable health care. Not excessive health care. I mean, the fact is we've got to make sure that what has happened in the past, and we know that, there have been a lot of tests that have been performed and a lot of costs that, frankly, has spiraled out of control. So we have to have a baseline that exists for Americans because this country has promised that in the sense of being a land of opportunity for all its people. And the resources that we have in this country are such that we have to make sure that the least among us are protected. So I hope that one day we'll see that happen.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to Stephen Zak, President of the American Bar Association. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's U.S. Constitution in the 21st Century series, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. And we thank them, and we thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
All right.